Welcome to Cracking Backs, where we unmask the giants of wellness, business, and reality TV. Today, we're thrilled to have the formidable Deandra Simmons with us. From heading a renowned skincare company to stirring magic in the kitchen as a master chef and lighting up your screens as a real Dallas housewife, Deandra truly epitomizes the phrase, wearing many hats. But did you know about her globe-trotting exploits, venturing into some of the rawest corners of the world? Fueled by an insatiable passion for anti-aging and health, her journeys have significantly influenced her innovative formulations. Deandra's successful on-screen career and her candid emotional vulnerability have inspired many, even as she navigates the complex labyrinth of public expectations. Her story takes a deeper turn. However, when faced with the impact of cancer in her family, out of a personal tragedy, Deandra, together with her mother, Dee, embarked on a quest for healthier living and dedicated their lives to helping others. Their tireless efforts have given birth to Ultimate Living International, a beacon of wellness offering superior nutritional supplements and skincare products. Today, as the president and CEO, Deandra carries on this legacy of healing and transformation, one person at a time. Join us as we delve into her world of resilience, innovation, and indomitable spirit.
All right, welcome to the show, Deandra. Well, you know, I actually struggled where we were going to begin with this because you wear so many hats and owner of a major skincare company, accomplished chef, now you're on the set of The Real Housewives of Dallas. Not that you're not real to be, you know, before that show started, yet. Many people may not know about your accomplishments. I can't talk. In world travel. In fact, when I walk through your house and I'm looking at all the statues and the mask and the beautiful artwork, I assumed it was your husband. And he goes, no, that's all my wife. And he goes, in fact, we argue all the time who's traveled the most. Yep. And so, especially with some of the, you know, the raw places you've been to, not just the fancy Paris, Rome, and all that. Did your passion for anti-aging compel you to travel the world, or, and what influences did this have on the formulation of your thoughts on health and wellness?
Well, Terry, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you wanting to speak to me after having my husband on, because, you know, it's kind of interesting to have a husband and wife at different times and different stories. And just to kind of follow up on your question, Jeremy and I argue all the time about who's been to more countries. And he always claims that he has. I claim that I have. And we bought one of those maps where you put the little push pins in. We ran out of push pins, so we just gave up. So, I mean, the thing is, it got so filled up. The map got so filled up that we couldn't put any more push pins in unless we buy one the size of a huge wall. So, you know, maybe in our next house, we'll do that. But I don't know. I think we've both been about 75 or 80 countries. My love of travel started, I believe, as an only child that was a very well-read, nerdy only child. I was a different person when I started my life than I am today. I was a straight A student, not really like the most popular person in my class. I was always reading books. I was always, I did a little dance and a little music and little things like that, but I was not very gregarious or social. And so being an only child with no siblings, it kind of, my mother and father were older. I entertained myself at home, and I entertained myself by losing myself in the world of books. And those books would take me on adventures to foreign lands, to down, you know, the rabbit hole at Alice in Wonderland and the wardrobe with, The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, and all these different books that I would read growing up, and then Nancy Drew Mysteries and everything. And then moving on to, of course, To Kill a Mockingbird and all the kind of things we had to read in school, Catcher in the Rye, whatever it is. I just was fascinated with adventure and books, and I would imagine in my head my life going on these adventures with these people. And then I started reading books about different countries and when I got into school, when I was older in school, math was never my thing, but English, I was a straight A student. I won the English award in high school and college by my creative writing abilities. And I still would love to write if I had the time. Unfortunately, I don't have as much time as I used to. But when I was, I guess, about 12 to 14, my first, if I can remember, my first real international trip was to the Middle East with my parents. And we went to the Holy Land and explored that. We went to Egypt. We went to Jordan. We went to, of course, Israel. And I can't remember where else we went. But I was just fascinated with this other part of the world and the way people lived, and the people were so different, but we inhabited the same planet. So I was kind of by that, that bit me that, you know, at that time, it totally bit me, that bug for travel. And then I decided, I'm smart. My parents, I can convince them to let me go all over the world and study. So I would find, I'm not kidding you, from like 14 on, a summer program in a different country for children. And I would go all over the world and study. And so that's why I traveled so much. I found a program in India. I found a program in Brazil, in Uruguay, in Paraguay, in Argentina, in, let's see, Cambodia, Vietnam. You know, I went to Singapore. I went to a lot of the Africa. I've been all over Africa, more countries than Jeremy. But to Africa. So I spent a lot of time. I've been to Africa 17 times. And the reason is because I fell so in love with Africa and its peoples and its history. And, you know, they say all of us originate from some part of Africa in the world. And so every time I go there, I feel like I cry when I get there because I'm so happy. I feel like I'm some part of me is home. And then when I leave, I cry because I have to leave. And there's so much history and strife. And, you know, you have the history of colonialism and everything else. So it's a very fascinating world that we live in. And if you have the opportunity to travel and to learn and to meet people and to explore their world and their life, then you should. And going into skincare, I had a business. My mother is a cancer survivor. Ultimate Living is her business that I inherited. And with her, I traveled the world because when she became ill with cancer, she was a model. She was 5'8". She was skinny. She was gorgeous. She never had an illness or a sneeze or anything. And then she got sick and had cancer. And so she decided to travel the world and meet with these different doctors and nutritionists and stem cell people, which back in the 80s and 90s was, you know, you had to go to Europe for all that kind of stuff. And we went to Tijuana for different treatments. And so I thought, okay, we're learning about these different products all over the world. Let me then turn that into part of my traveling. And when I created skincare, I went to women all over the world. And then when I married Jeremy, it was wonderful because he could take the photos and tell the stories of, you know, a woman in Africa. Why are you using ochre and painting your body with that? Or why are you using shea butter? Or why are you using the sausage tree, which is Kigelia? Or why are you using argan oil or whatever it is? So that was kind of something I felt like I could then take my trips and work it into my business and then learn about other women and what they do and how they take care of their bodies and their skin and may not have the access and the resources that we have to spend money on sunscreens and everything else, but they'll find a way to do it. And of course, the Asian women have the most beautiful skin in the world. They don't go in the sun. Yet, you know, we loved our sun over here and we like to be tan. So you just learn so many things. And the way I learned and got into these cultures with these women was to talk about their beauty habits, maybe their hair. Some of them do hair extensions. And I would say, well, tell me about your hair extensions because we do hair extensions. And then they would let me braid their hair. And then we would talk food because I love to eat. And, you know, what do you cook for your family? And what are your rituals in your home? And I was able to go into one of the Himba women's private tents. And, you know, they never take a bath, but twice in their life, once when they're born and once when they're married. And they do this other ceremony throughout their life to cleanse themselves, which is very interesting. But I was able to witness that because I had developed a relationship. So I think travel is so important. I mean, it's all about what you enjoy in your life. It's something I enjoy. Some people, I have a friend that doesn't have a passport. He didn't want a passport. He didn't care. But I do. You know, mine's always up to date. I hope that answered some of your questions. And that way I, Terry, got ingredients that I then used in my formulations, in my skincare, Hard Night, Good Morning, and also in my nutrition products.
Wow. Deandra, I want that is absolutely fascinating, and you really immersed yourself in deeply into, you know, different cultures to understand how it can affect our bodies in different ways, usually mostly in a positive manner. But what were some of the challenges that you met up with and maybe some surprises that you faced when you, you know, applied those, some of the principles from other countries and brought them to yourself and others?
Some of the challenges were resourcing those products. So for instance, you know, I wish I would have been 20 years ago on the cutting edge of like something like an argan oil, which Josie Moran found in Africa, because she created a whole line off that. And, you know, I didn't think at the time, now I know a lot more, but getting those products, whether you have to source them from overseas or close to home, or now having them grown at home, you know, we can do that as well, costing them. Of course, in the last few years with the pandemic, it's been a stress on everyone in my industry trying to get raw materials. Even for my Ultimate Living line, I have the Miracle Pain Cream that people love that have joint problems. I've had arthritis and I live with chronic pain. So finding some of the ingredients, just like, for instance, one of the ingredients in skincare is carbomer, which is like it makes it kind of slicky so you can apply it. Mm-hmm. Couldn't get it anywhere for 3 years. So then you have to go, okay, what are we going to use instead? Same thing with components, same thing with find something South America or a specific source of, you know, a CBD, for instance, is in some of our products. All of those things are challenges. I will find out when I learned about the sausage tree, which was in the bush because I had gotten an injury. You cut it off. It looks like a big sausage. It grows off a tree and you put it on your skin and it heals your skin. I went home to ask my lab and they're like, what? What are you talking about? I said, well, find it. And this is the other name for it. So finding ingredients. May I call you? Do you want to call you Dr. Barron or Spencer? Which one?
Spencer's fine. Okay, Spencer. Thank you.
You're welcome. So those are some of the challenges that I found historically. And then where do you want to source? So aloe vera, you can source it in South America. You can source it in, I'm not South America, source it in South Africa. You can source it in Mexico. Used to, I've sourced it in South Africa. Now in Mexico, they have a really nice aloe from the Mojave Valley with great clinicals. So kind of also looking at the ingredients, where they come from, how those people are taking care of the land and the ingredients that they're providing and what kind of chemicals and pesticides they're using, if they are using them. And you have to just do your research and know all of that. So for instance, our green foods product, we make that. Our green foods are grown in like Utah, just like our minerals come from the Great Salt Lake in a pristine area. We get them from cutting process into a can within like 2 to 3 hours with flash freezing them. So it's very fresh. All of those things as a manufacturer, you have to know who's manufacturing your product and make sure you stay on top of it. And I've been doing it for almost 30 years. So I know a lot about the industry, but still to this day, there's constant, industry regulations. Then of course we completely don't get anything. I'll be honest with you, I don't get any raw materials from Asia, not Asia, but China. I don't get anything from China just because I don't trust what, you know, I'm going to get. So Korea is a little bit easier, Taiwan, but then, you know, there's political issues. So you got to deal with political issues as well overseas and ingredient sourcing. And are you getting what you think you're getting? So,
you know, I'm going to back up a little bit because you brought up a interesting, you know, obviously Dr. Terry and I we take care of patients that are in pain. Yes. I like what you said about was it the sausage root or the, what was it that?
Kigelia tree, which is sausage tree. And it's basically heals wounds, burns, cuts that you might get in the bush. You just cut a piece off and put it on there, wrap it around your arm, and it'll heal a lot faster. I also, another example of this was when I was in Zanzibar and I stepped on a sea urchin and I was in the middle of nowhere. And so the local people went to a tree and cut a fruit off of a tree and the sap put on my foot. And I believe it may have been some sort of a cashew fruit or mango or something. I don't know, but the white sap and put it on there. I was dying in pain, but there was nothing else to do. That was it. And that's what they did. And it worked. So you learn when you have to, you make things work, and they make things work in their environment. And so they then treat you in their environment, and you don't have to have a medical answer as far as, you know, a prescription for everything.
You know, that's really interesting. We had a guest that kind of was talking about this. I'm going to ask you a question. It seems like when we, as humans on this earth, when we have a problem, it seems like, and I'm going to get a little religious, it seems like God puts something on the earth to fix it. Mm-hmm. And there's always a solution in nature. Even we can talk about healing the brain with psychedelics, you know. There always seems like there's something in nature that can fix it. And man screwed it up by moving it into a lab,
right,
and using all these chemicals that don't exist in nature. And we wonder why we have all these side effects. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that something you've discovered in 30 years that and some of the most intelligent people aren't PhDs. They're people that live in the bush and have found out what works. Is that,
yes,
is that something you've discovered?
I actually would like to go to Peru and kind of peruse the, you know, the medicines down there. I have actually done the psychedelics myself. So I've tried, which ones? Ayahuasca. I did ayahuasca 3 or 4 times. Jeremy did an ayahuasca trip, but he documented it. He did not do the ayahuasca. So I went to Mexico and did it with a place I felt comfortable. I've done it here. I mean, I'm not supposed to do it here in the United States. But,
you know, I mean, I've done it here. Thank God you did between your fingers.
Yeah, here, not in my home, but somewhere close to home. You know, just there's, and you just have to be in a trusted environment. And there's controversy. One of my friends who owns a company, she makes gemstone spray. She doesn't believe in it. She thinks it's bad. I had one not so great experience, a couple of okay experiences. I don't know if I'd do it again. I don't know. I have a lot of background trauma and chronic pain and things like that. That's why I was doing it. So I don't know how many treatments I would need, but it does work wonders for people. I know people that were serious drug addicts that went on and did Ibogaine and are completely recovered. And I believe in that because of their stories they have told me. You know, there's people that have, done, you know, Bufo and Combo and all that kind of stuff too. I have not done that. I was going to try the Combo for the arthritis and the chronic pain, but, I haven't been able to go down to South America and do that. And when I was really having bad pain was during the pandemic. And obviously there was no traveling down there to do those kind of things. But, I believe that you kind of have to kind of go with what your heart and your intuition and your belief system tells you. It's a belief system thing. In my religion, and we brought up Christians, you don't do these things. However, we also have free will and we have God who gives us a brain to research and find our own answers to things. And that's why I can basically justify, you know, helping myself with resources that I may find. So, and, you know, that's what I believe.
So my question goes back to these remedies that are called, considered home remedies based on where you're at on the planet Earth. Now, mm-hmm. I could see cutting a piece of, you know, tree or leaf or bark right off the tree and applying it and see, you know, and allowing the natural biology or biological transition to take place. But now how do you produce that, mass produce that, and manufacture that, but still maintain the essence of its greatest effects on the body or the intended effects? Because, you know, you hear about all these companies putting out, you know, like say CBD, and man, we've tried so many and they don't work as they say they do, but, you know, and then you find out that, you know, it doesn't have the stated ingredients or the amounts and all that. How do you keep that, you know, intact, or how do you make it as effective as it is when you're, you know, in the native country?
Well, so for CBD, you're absolutely right. It's wildly varies in efficacy. Yeah. Unfortunately. So I tried a brand for, like I said, chronic pain, but I did like the tinctures and the oils. And it was great for about 6 months. And then all of a sudden didn't work anymore. And so my thought process was they're probably sourcing it from someplace else, either cheaper or a different plant or a different company. So I don't know the answer to that question, but it just stopped working. I've had other products like that just don't work. It's hard. So for us, we use it for topical application. It's not for internal. We're not taking it, ingesting it. So ours right now, we've had two products we've made with CBD, but we've only done one run. And so the first run was great. Now I get a second run. You know, I get to try it out before they do the run. And I make sure I ask, is it the same product as before? And then you get the clinicals on the product that they provide from the manufacturer. And then the other thing is with tinctures. So for instance, or with a Kegelia, which is the sausage tree, when I'm making an extract, let's use green tea, for example, then I bring the green tea, whatever the green tea is, I will go to the lab and I will steep it at the right temperature, the right level, because you can't, not all tea is meant to be boiled. So that's a very important thing. So green tea is different from oolong tea or different from black tea or different from, and all these different properties. So you have to prepare them at the right level. And then you put them in at that level. And I've been in the lab for 20 something years, making sure those things are done. And then my mother, Spencer, used to make a product that, I don't know if you've heard this product, probably in the chiropractic world, it was Easyac tea. Did you ever know the story of Renee Cass?
No, but I've heard of the tea. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Renee Cass was a woman that I believe was in Canada. If I remember the story correct, my mom sold this a long time ago, and she had some sort of cancer. And so she went to the local OBGYN or something, Indians, whatever, Ojibwa Indians. And they made her this tea of different herbs. And the herbs, to my best recollection, burdock, slippery elm, Turkish rhubarb, there's a couple other, I don't know, I'd have to go back. We have a formula. We used to make it. So, and it's wonderful for the immune system. It also, we put cat's claw in ours. Now, cat's claw is great for some people, but some people are allergic to it. I developed an allergy to it, unfortunately. The original formula for Easyac tea did not have cat's claw. But I have a nutrition company. I can't say this cures cancer. I could just sell it to build your immune system, you know, and it did work very well. And it was one of our best sellers. But it was a product that we had to very much educate people on because they didn't understand it. Also a very expensive product to make because every single herb in that formula had to be boiled at a different temperature. So if I'm going to a lab and they're just throwing it in a pot, it's not going to work. It's going to stop working. So I would have to make sure, and it was very expensive, that they would boil the burdock over here at this temperature. The slippery elm goes at this temperature. The Turkish rhubarb is at this temperature. And like I said, I can't remember all the sheep sorrel was in it too. That had to be at this temperature. So you have to make sure you're, as an owner of a company, which a lot of nutrition companies do not do this, you're on top of it. And the reason I know so much is because I've been in it for so long. My mother and my father were very interested in making products of integrity. My father, at one time with his brother, had 63 companies. And he said to us, don't ever embarrass this family. You know, don't embarrass this family. I'll let you do this because this is your passion. But don't embarrass me and don't tell me. I wish I would have had more money and come back and say, well, you didn't give me enough money to start this business. And I couldn't get the best product. We're not doing that. He said, buy the best and make sure it's the best and I'll support you. So I really was very lucky to have a family that was supported in every way with my father and my mother. I'm the only child. So to watch them, my mother had that business for, 18, 19, more than that years before she finally turned it over to me. That was a big story on the show. So, but I learned a lot from both of them.
Deandra, you know, it's all fascinating. And I love the understanding of human behavior more than anything. And it's, you know, it's interesting to hear, you know, what you share with such passion. But, you know, many people know, you know, Deandra Simmons is like the businesswoman, the TV personality, and, you know, which is what you do. But I think what we really love to know is who you are, what drives you, what gives you that passion. Because, you know, anybody could have a little bit of money or a ton of money, but there's that one ingredient that motivates you and gets you out of bed in the morning, even when you don't want to. So what is that? What is that characteristic that you possess that allows you to be successful?
It's funny that you asked this because Jeremy and I were talking about this recently and he said, what's your purpose in life? And I go, oh. And I said, well, do you want a long purpose or you want a short purpose? But then I thought, you know, I need to get it down to one sentence. So I developed one sentence, and I believe that everybody can have one sentence, and they basically make that their credo and aspire to that every single day and live their life for that one sentence. Don't get convoluted and I need 50,000 things. So my one sentence is to live my life authentically in order to inspire others. That's it. That's my one sentence. So whatever I do every day, it has to be authentic. It has to be true to who I am and to my brand. And I have to, in some way, inspire other people by doing that. Because if I'm not doing that, then why am I here? I mean, am I here just to live my life for me? Because that would be a very sad, vapid life to just live for yourself. And I also do not have children, Spencer. I have stepchildren. So I don't have my own children to pass on my belief system to. So I have Jeremy's children. I hope I inspire them with what I do. And I hope that other children that I've taken on through the years that I've helped in different ways are inspired by me or in some way make decisions in a more thoughtful, pragmatic way and care about other people because I have shown that to them. So that's really, in a very simple answer to your question, how I kind of every day I get up out of bed and just mark my, or my compass goes towards that one saying that I just created and said. But I also spent about 4 months writing a document on who I was, and it went from literally hundreds of words down to 6 words. And that was kind of the beginning of really kind of chunking down of, okay, I'm a big picture person, but I've got to figure out, I'm a big picture person with a lot of ideas, but what is the real core of who you are? And once you decide what your core is, then you can serve humanity and serve other people. And you really have to, but you have to develop what your purpose is and why you're here. If you don't have a direction and you're a compass without, you know, without any direction at all, I mean, you're just a wandering ship. So that's the thing that I really wanted to, and it took me a long time to get there. It's not just an overnight thing, but I challenge everyone that listens to this podcast to come up with your one sentence purpose in life. Mm-hmm. Just because mine says live my life authentically to inspire others doesn't mean that's yours. Yours might be to be the best CPA in the world and teach my kids math. I don't know what it is. And yours might be to treat patients with integrity and honesty and loyalty and whatever. I don't know what it is, but that's not my thing to tell you. But it is my job to inspire you to create one mantra for yourself.
When you're overseas, or no, well, heck, even in the United States, and you're asking somebody about how they take care of themselves, whether it be skincare or anti-aging, and the moment you start talking, I mean, you've spoken to people from all over the world, whether it's through a translator or what have you. I mean, this is what I imagine. I mean, do you get excited to ask the question that, you know, whatever it comes up regarding health or wellness, and what is it that, you know, excites you? Is it in preparation for the answer? Is it because you can live authentically and people feel that when you're asking them, you're leaning in, your eyes are big and, you know, you're anxious to hear their answer. What's that moment that turns you on when you start communicating with someone from another country, another world?
What really turns me on is, like I told you at the beginning, we're on this planet, but yet we go to someplace else, another continent, and it's so vastly different. You think, how can I be living on the same planet as this person? So when I ask them a question about taking care of their family or how they live their life and what kind of remedies or products they use or how they even cook for their family. Cooking is a very big way to bring people together. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, and I love food. So I love to cook and I love to share my recipes and my stories about how my family brought each other together with food. My grandmothers and my father, and we all came together with food. And I think everyone in the world does that. So that's a commonality. I talk to them about that, and I'm fascinated by every ingredient, every kind of thing they're creating, why they're eating this, why they're doing that. And then I also, what are your routines? What are your, how do you take care of your children? How do you, what's, you know, how do you, work within the constraints of whatever your nuclear family or whatever your marriage, you know, rights are. I don't know what those, some people have, you know, a lot of wives and things, and that's their way of living their life. Are you okay with that? How do you feel about that? I've asked those questions. I don't have a problem asking those questions. I mean, they answer, you know, I don't mind if he has Sarah and Jane and Abby, you know, it's fine. I mean, it's like, that's what their norm is. Okay. So tell me about living with Sarah and Jane and Abby and Julie and your husband, you know, Ralph. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's just something I learn. I'm learning, learning, learning. And I believe my husband calls me Curious George because he's like, you ask so many questions. Oh my God. He's like, you're like that little Curious George monkey. You're always, you know, Curious George. He's always called me Curious George. But I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I was probably that kid in school that asked too many questions and people were like, oh God, her again. Oh my God, you know, or she's going to answer that question. Oh, I'll answer the question. I'll answer the question. I probably was that person, but it served me well in life later on because if you don't ask, you don't know. And I could care what, I don't give a rip, as my mother says, what those kids in school thought about me because I was going to get to the bottom of it. And I was not going to get to test day and not know the answer because I was too embarrassed to answer the, to ask the question.
So let's go out maybe 30, 50, 100 years from today. What is the legacy that you want to leave behind? What is it that you want to be known for 100 years from now? Let's say 50 years from now.
That's a very interesting question because of the fact that I have so many things that I do. And there's so many ways that I show my caring and compassion for people, whether it be with my food, my nutrition products, my skincare products, my humanitarian work, work with veterans like Jeremy and I work, you know, we work a lot of veterans programs. I work with women of domestic violence. I am a survivor of domestic violence. I probably didn't tell you that before I met him. So those are the things that are really important to me to talk about, to share with people. So when I leave a legacy, I want my brands to live on as authentically products that were created by a woman who, like I said, lived my life authentically to inspire other people. I also want people to know about my food and my my friendships and my relationships and, you know, all the different things that are important to me. And it's, that's the one question when I could do my one mantra, but what is my legacy has been kind of puzzling me for the last, I would say more after I turned 50. So the last 5 years, I've been puzzled by what's my legacy going to be. So my mother's a cancer survivor who helped other people and she's a patient advocate and that's important to her. However, how do you fit acting in there, being a chef, having brands, there's just so many things, but I hope that my legacy, forget all the ancillary things I create. Maybe there's one person that whose life I change and that's the most important thing. And that's it. And somebody remembers that. I certainly don't want Spencer, my tombstone to say she was a real housewife. That's the last thing I want. Because that's the least of my accomplishments. Okay. Every time people say that, I was like, let's just scoot right past that. Okay. And move on to the next thing. Cause that was just a way to drive a brand for me.
Well, I think would be great is if that time, when that time comes on the tombstone, it would say she was real, period.
Yeah. She was real. She was authentic. She was real. Yeah. She was a wife. She was a stepmom. She was a friend. She cared about other people, that kind of thing.
Agreed. You know, on that note, when I was in Dallas and before I even been to your house, I knew I wanted you on the show after talking to your husband and your husband and I sat around your pool when you weren't around and we had this amazing talk. And so I knew I wanted you on the show. So I started asking people questions when we were on the Carry the Load walk about you.
Oh, no.
I wanted to learn. And I wanted to do some, you know, to figure out a couple of things. Do you know not one person mentioned your brands or your businesses or your acting career? Everything I got back was you're emotionally honest and your vulnerability. That you wear your heart on your sleeve. And my question to you is, That is the perception I got, that you wear this heart in the sleeve and you're the most open and honest and real person. I mean, it's funny, you're on a show called The Real Housewives and you're probably the realest one on there. And so how do you manage this form of openness? And, you know, what is this, you know, how has this characteristics affected your personal and professional relationships? But the main thing is, how do you, in this world of business and in a man's world or whatever you want to call it, traveling around the world and all this stuff, how do you manage this form of openness and vulnerability?
That's something that I made a decision to do. And my mother, I think, wishes I didn't make such a decision to do, to be so open. Because her generation was not open. Her generation was, oh, let's not talk about the dirty laundry. Let's just, you know, scoot over that. What was it? Ann Landers says, put out your trash or talk about, you know, your dirty laundry. And my mother always reminds me of that. Why are you doing that? Ann Landers says, don't do that. You know, so, but my generation is tell everything. Most people. I mean, not everybody. When I decided to be a real housewife, what Jeremy and I sat down, I said, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it authentically, 100% real, good, bad, ugly, because I want people to see the highs and the lows, the peaks and valleys in a marriage, in a business, in a relationship with a mother, in a relationship with children, stepchildren, and friendships. And so I stayed true to that. Now, when people talk about me on the show, they say what you said, Terry, that I'm the realest Real Housewife on my franchise, because I do share everything. And the good, the bad, the ugly. I don't, like, for instance, one of the girls thought she was going to be very crafty and talk about my financial resources at the time when I was trying to take my company over from my mother, and we were struggling. And I just said, yeah, I'm having problems financially. And she thought I was going to lie about it and hide it and cover it up. I didn't hide it. I didn't cover it up. It's people go through that. People sometimes have $200 in their bank account. Okay, so what? You know, you're not going to watch me anymore because I can't, you know, I pay my bills on time. I mean, but is that going to be something that you're going to cancel before? I mean, because I'm telling you the truth about my life, about the struggles that we have. Like I said, my mother is not a fan of my telling everything the way it really is and being so transparent. My husband doesn't mind it. He knows who I am, and he knows that I always come to the table with my truth and honesty. And the one thing about it, we said, don't lie on that show. Don't lie on that show. Be who you are. If you make mistakes, own up to it and move on. And every mistake that I was called out for, I'm like, yeah, I did it. Okay, move on. Even when Andy would say something on a reunion that was very negative towards me about my past that somebody would bring up. And I mean, not everybody has a great past. I've told you, you know, the domestic violence and other things. I'd be like, yeah, I did it. Okay. And next question, please. Because when you start covering up and lying, and then you have to get another lie, another lie, another lie, and then you're eventually going to be found out. So just own up to it the first day and just be done with it. Because then people forget about it. They're on to the next thing because you've told the truth and you've been honest and vulnerable, and what are they going to do to you? Because you came out and said, yeah, I did that. You're right. I mean, what can they really say at that point? Well, on the show, it was hard for me because the other women, and I don't want to talk negative, but they were not as open as me. A lot of them were not as open about their marriages or about their struggles. And I think that with regards to other franchises, you see that a lot more than you saw that in Dallas. But if you look at the Southern woman in Texas, they hide a lot of things with, you know, our hair extensions, our plastic surgery, our this, our that, our everything is a smoke and mirrors down here. It's like a mini LA. So it makes sense to me that they didn't want to share all of their truth on the show, or they picked, it was a cherry picking situation. And I was just like, okay, here's 15 things happening in my life. What do you want to talk about? And of course, they would pick the most difficult one. So the last season I was on, they talked about the struggle with my stepmother and my brother, who they don't talk to me. And that was very difficult. Of course, Robbo was like, let's go talk about this and let's go highlight this. And it caused a bigger problem in my family. And they still don't talk to me because I was honest. And I went there and I talked about it. I talked with Jeremy about it. And then I tried to get my stepmother to talk to me, and on camera, she wouldn't do it. So it's you know, and I knew that when she did talk to me on camera, she was going to say a lot of negative things about me, about my character. But I was willing to go there and own up to it if it was going to happen. So that's the difference. I knew what was going to happen. I knew she was going to say a lot of negative things. My father, my biological father, committed suicide. And after that, there was a big rift in the family. So I knew there were going to be a lot of deleterious comments made about me, but I was willing to say, okay, I'll do this in front of the camera because maybe some other people are struggling. And I know I'm going to get just lambasted from people, but at the same time, maybe I can help somebody. It's a very difficult. I just think if you sign up for a reality show, it's called a reality show. It's not called acting. It's a difference.
Right.
When I go on set and I'm an actress, I'm acting as another character. When I'm on Real Housewives, I'm myself and we're sharing our stories. So I think that's, I will tell you that over when it's happening, it's very stressful. And you have a lot of people on social media that are, you know, the peanut gallery talking very negatively to you and saying horrible things to you. And they, of course, know everything about your life. And,
right.
You know, you're the ugliest, fattest person in the world and they can't believe you're on TV. And it's like, I mean, it just goes on and on. And wow. So then when it's off now, 2-3 years later, people say, oh, I rewatched the show, or you were very Dallas. You were true to Dallas. You were true to yourself. You were true to your family. Mm. Thank you for representing Dallas in the right way, in the positive way, not positive, but in the true way. You know, I mean, I tried to be positive, but it's a reality show. At the end of the day, you're going to fight. They want you to fight. That's what it is. It's drama. So it wasn't like my character. The reality, being on a reality show isn't really something that is, it's not something I enjoy. It was something I really did not enjoy. Mm-hmm. Would I go back? Maybe to help my brands a little bit. I have one more year on my contract, so I don't really have a choice, you know. But it's not my favorite. It wasn't my favorite job, I'll just be honest with you.
Well, you seem to have navigated it quite well. I remember back in many years ago, I was getting a divorce. My, people love talking about it. My mom calls me up and she says, wow, you know, I heard some not so nice things about you and your friends, your ex-wife, your ex-friends, whatever, they seem to be enjoying talking, you know, coming up with conversations about all the negative. And I said, Mom, I think it's great because the National Enquirer does not write about people that are not famous. In other words, I must be something because I'm actually excited that they can talk about it because you know what? The truth will always persist. And it will, if it exists, it persists, which means I will outlive all the negative stuff. I will, in the end, always show the truth. So how did you navigate through all that garbage? And what did you say to yourself? And what advice would you give to people that aren't as strong as you are personally and, you know, obviously professionally? What is that? What is that?
You have to. Or the first 2 years, Spencer, I was in the floor crying all the time because I was reading all these horrible things about me online that weren't true. And why? At first, I would fight back with these people. And I'm like, why am I fighting? They don't know me. They're probably sitting in their parents' basement eating potato chips. I mean, I don't know who these people are. They have a picture of their cat. Always. There's always a picture of their cat. So, or some animated thing. It's ridiculous. You don't know what they look like. They never have any followers, but they follow everyone that's on TV and they comment about everything about your life. So that gives me the first clue about why am I caring about what this person thinks about me, okay? The second thing is, yes, I did develop a thick skin. So, and what that means is, once again, am I living my life authentically? If I am, why do I care what these people think about me? Because they don't know me anyway. If they met me on the street, okay, they're following me because I'm famous, right? If they met me on the street, these people hate me and say horrible, garbagey things about me, but they're going to ask me for a photo. Aren't they? They're going to ask me for a photo for sure, especially if it looked bad. So they can post a picture of the photo of me. Yeah, you know, and I'll give them the photo. That's fine. It's they entertain themselves with gossiping online, with being negative about other people's lives. But really, they're miserable in their own lives and they're very insecure. I don't comment on people online in a negative way. I will say nice things. I won't say nasty things. Even if I don't like you, I'm not going to say anything about it. there's a person on my on our show that was fired, I guess, a couple years ago. And I guess, what was it, like 6 months ago, went on a podcast and said horrible things about me. I haven't talked to the woman in 4 years, but apparently I'm a phony. I'm completely broke. I'm, you know, so poor that I can barely pay my bill. It's just on and on and on, you know. And here I am moving into this beautiful new home. And she's saying all this stuff about me. And I just thought, and I didn't answer it. I mean, I just, because why fight back with her? Because the only thing I said on Twitter, somebody said, aren't you going to say something? And I said, lions don't concern themselves with sheep. That's my answer.
Oh, you know, and on that same note, I quote him all the time because I just think he's amazing. But David Goggins has a statement that nobody, and he takes all the negativity and he made it into a reel that he listens to when he works out and it pumps him up. And he says, instead of listening to music, I listen to all the negativity because I realized that nobody above me will ever say anything negative to somebody below you. Mm-hmm. So it's only people below you that will say something negative.
That's true.
And so he goes, I figured the more people below me blowing hot air, it will lift me up when I feel like I'm falling. So he plays these tapes over and over just to pump them up. Mm-hmm. But I love when he would say that nobody above you will ever say anything negative. So you almost have to draw from that when you're getting negativity, you almost feel sorry that they're in that world because it's not you, you know?
I don't really think about it and dwell on it. I'm one of the last people to know about people's gossip in their lives, about who's having an affair, about whose kids are doing drugs. I don't engage in those conversations because I don't have time and it's none of my business. If you want to come to me and talk to me because you want advice or how to handle something, but I'm not going to go tell people and call Susie and tell Susie that Jill said this to me. And if you have a lot of time on your hands, that's what you're doing. I don't have time on my hands for that. But it's also, not if I'm living my life the way we talked about it, it's not my business what other people think about me. That's they can think whatever they want about me. That's they can develop their own opinion. I don't need to fight with them and tell them that they're wrong. I just have to keep on. It's about looking at the golden ring. I'm sure, I don't know if Jeremy told you this, staying focused, staying in your lane, keeping on your path of what you are doing. And don't get sidetracked by the cat person over here that says, you know, you shouldn't be on TV because you're so ugly and hideous. And I hope you die and get hit by a bus and fall in a ditch. Who cares what the cat person says? Because the cat person probably doesn't have a job. So otherwise, they wouldn't have time to talk all day long on Twitter about you and your miserable, horrible, poor life, you know?
I love it. Okay, now we are going to switch gears, Deandra, and whether you know about our rapid fire questions or not, I got five of them. I don't know if Jeremy warned you, but they are going to be quick and fun. Are you ready?
No, but before you start, Spencer, I don't want people to go, you hate cats. I don't hate cats. I'm just saying that people have pictures of cats all over social media when they don't want to put pictures themselves. Put a picture of a dog. I mean, whatever. It's something that's not you is what I'm trying to say. Okay. It could be a cartoon character. I don't know. I mean, okay. Let's do the rapid fire. Yeah.
No. Wait. There you go. Hey. I'm so glad you mentioned that because when you said it, in the back of my mind, I thought, we're going to get so many cat-loving people hating us right now. And I go, I don't care. That's fine. But no, I'm glad you clarified.
That they always choose to put a picture of a cat is bizarre to me. Yeah. Choose something else. Put a picture of a vegetable, but not an eggplant.
Not an eggplant. That is great. Oh, I got to plug in here. Hold on a second. All right. So our rapid fire. If you're ready, we are with question number one. Besides baking blueberry pies, what is your second favorite thing to cook?
Oh, this is rapid fire. Does it have to be a pie?
No. It could be anything. We just know a little history about you and blueberry pies.
A tomahawk steak.
Really? All right. Why?
Because I like to cook on live firewood. So the hanging tomahawk steaks, it's very cool. presentation, and then it just tastes delicious. And you take some rosemary and you take some, you know, seasoning, salt and pepper, then you take the rosemary and thyme and brush it around with some olive oil, and it tastes really nice.
So let me ask you, Terry, did she just completely blow off the blueberry pie conversation?
Jeremy, Matt Hughes, and Garrett are going to be so disappointed in that answer.
I don't know if he told you, but I made him a blueberry fried pie last weekend.
Last weekend. All right. That's news.
Blueberry fried. I make little hand pies, fried pies. So I made a blueberry custard fried pie, and he liked it. And it was not bad, but I'm not a huge blueberry fan. Do you know that we owned a blueberry farm? Did he tell you this story? We had more blueberries. They were coming out of our ears because my father owned the largest blueberry farm in the South at one point. And so we had, like, literally my mother would fly a plane up there and get blueberries every year. And I got so sick of blueberries. So, you know, he made a lot of good money off blueberries for years and years. But blueberries are, I'll eat them at breakfast or in a shake, but I'm not a blueberry pie person. Jeremy's a Yankee. That's a Yankee thing. People in South eat blueberry pie.
How come Jeremy didn't tell us that part of that conversation?
I said, it's because you're a Yankee. Blueberry, all that weird stuff, rhubarb. No, thank you. I don't want any of that.
Question number two. What happened in the African bush? More specifically, Caprock Canyon.
That wasn't the African bush. He almost killed me in Texas. That's Texas.
Oh.
He didn't tell you this? He took me out. Okay, of course, it's my fault because I didn't get up on time. That's what he says. But, I mean, I didn't know it was going to be 130 degrees. So we left at 8 instead of 6. And it was an 8-mile hike. And it was 130 degrees and we didn't have enough water. And I had some friends that didn't think ahead and bring enough water for themselves. So I got out and I had to go to the ambulance. And by that point, I was not sweating at all when you get so dehydrated.
Yeah.
And putting the cold towels all over me. And then all of a sudden, I just was gushing water. So I was very proud of myself because I was in my 50s. I made it in and out all by myself without the care flight having to come. And I walked. God. And there were several people that were younger than me that had to be carried out or rescued.
All right. So you're a badass. See,
that's what a good athlete I am, even though Jeremy's going to say I'm not a good athlete.
Great. Question number three. When it comes to barbecue, what is the mistake most people make? And what is one hack to improve their skills right away?
Overcooking. High temperature, cook low and slow.
I like that.
Go ahead. Low and slow.
Slow.
Mm-hmm. Low and slow, and learn your grill or your smoker. If you don't know how to use your equipment, that's the biggest mistake I've seen. People don't know how to use their equipment, including me.
I love it. Low and slow. Okay. Question number four. When cooking with your husband, Jeremy, what is your favorite song, like a rock song, that you listen to in the kitchen?
Oh, Amy Winehouse, Rehab.
I would have never expected that one.
I'm an alto, and I can sing in that. I can sing.
I can hear
you. Now I've lost my voice. I've lost my voice because I had an audition last week that was 5 hours and I literally couldn't talk for 3 days. So, but normally, and in fact, I was worried about today that I could talk or not, but I have a lower voice. So I sing whatever she has on her. We have a record player. So Jeremy listens to weird music. Did you talk to him about this? He listens to weird music. Like Dee Antwood and all this alternative stuff I have no interest in. And rock, I mean, so rock, like hardcore heavy metal. Not heavy metal like Metallica, which is good taste. He has very bad taste. So, I mean, I don't even think his children would listen to what he listens to. It's so bad. So, and then, of course, he gets in the car with me and tries to change up all my music because I'm more traditional. And I also am from Texas. We have our country music. He hates country music.
Yeah.
So if you really want to irritate him, invite him to a country music concert. And tell him it's for veterans, so he has to go.
That's beautiful.
That's what he really irritated.
Oh, my gosh. Before question number five, Terry, I think we might need to get Jeremy back on for a part two so we can rematch. We got to give him a fighting chance.
We should go out and play the newlywed game. It'd be really fun.
That would be hilarious.
That would be fun.
Oh, man.
They're not newlyweds anymore, but, you know, the 10-year into it game or whatever you want to call it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that would be fun.
Like the dating game. I remember that show. All right, question number five. Last one. When you have had a hard night, what is your best tip to have a better morning besides using that product from your hard night good morning? I love that. I love that title. You got any tips for us?
Yeah, it's important to hydrate, whether it be with water or some sort of electrolyte drink that's not necessarily the commercial brands. You have a lot of electrolyte powders you can use that are holistic ones. I can't think of the names of ones I have, but collagen powders. And then also, I hate to tell you this, but if I had a hard night, like too much to drink, I'm going to eat something that's greasy and delicious and enjoy myself and not have too many thoughts about it later. I'm going to have a cheeseburger and I might have some french fries with it.
All right.
My favorite thing still is a cheeseburger. And I'll never, I think if I was my last meal, I would still eat a cheeseburger because I just love cheeseburgers. Yeah, I would love a cheeseburger. If it was my last meal, I'd have cheeseburger. So I don't eat them that often, but if I want my cheat day, I'm going to have a cheeseburger. And it's going to be, last week, Jeremy and I went and had a smash burger someplace. It was really good. And I have a friend that has Gotham Social Club that makes the best smash burger in the world in New York City. And he travels all around the country making them. He's been on Food Network. And that burger, that man can make a good burger. I mean,
Wow.
I'm not that fancy. I like my escargot and my caviar, but if it's my last meal, I'm going to have some hamburgers.
Love that. Love that.
Good answer.
You know, and sticking with the fun, you know, I got to ask you this. So how does a skincare guru, a cooking sensation guru, a TV personality guru land such an amazing man such as Jeremy Locke, you know? And I heard he was jumping up and down in the room when you texted him back, or was it the other way around?
So I met him. I don't know what he told you about that story, but when we met, I was in D.C. He was in D.C. We were staying at the same hotel, and I went to the bar because I wanted to get a glass of wine and take it to my room, not to sit at a bar by myself. But I had five stores that day where I went and talked about my skincare and sold to consumers. So I went in there, and I have this hat on. I wear a lot of hats, especially it was still chilly in D.C. in the beginning of March. And this gentleman said, one of his colleagues, "Oh, I love your hat. May we take a photo of you?" And I was like, "What? No." He said, "Well, we're doing a photojournalism workshop. Please do that. Please, like, it'd be great for the kids to take a photo of you outside. The lights are set up." So I agreed to do it. And then at the end, I said, "Okay, you know, I'm going to get my drink." He said, "Well, let us buy you a drink." I was like, "No, I'm tired. I've had a really long day." I looked over there at the table with all the guys. He goes, "The guys buy you a drink." And I saw Jeremy. I thought he was really good looking, and maybe I'm not so tired anymore. So I went over there and I made sure that I talked to him, but I think he was at the other side of the table and we had to, like, he had to move around. All these guys were trying to buy drinks and talk, and he had to move around. We finally spoke. And then I don't remember if the next night I saw them back there again. I don't know, but I was actually in a relationship with somebody and it was going very south very quickly. So I was introducing Jeremy to my best friend because she was single. I thought, well, this will be great. He's good looking. She'll like him. And so I brought her the next night, and that was not his type of woman. So I just said to him, "Look, I am not single." And I said, "I'm not in a relationship that I'm happy in, but I'm not going to compromise my relationship until I'm out. I got to be out of the relationship before I'm going to do anything here." So I said, "Here's my business card. Do not call me. Do not contact me. It's nice to meet you and move on with my life." And then I broke up. This is March. I broke up in June with the person I was with. And I was going to DC to do a Whole Foods holiday show. Now, somehow I guess I did have his number from the night that we texted. It was nice to meet you or something like that. And so I said, hey, I'm in town. I don't know if you remember me, but I was wanting to know if you wanted to have a drink. And that's not something I would do, but I had told him not to contact me. So he's not going to contact me. But he had my picture. I had a picture with my a card on his desk the whole time. So he obviously, we had one date and it went well. And then that was kind of it. But he was also playing the field. So I had to kind of, you know, put the screws to him. So I put the screws to him. And said, it's either me or the field. So decide. And you get 30 days to make a decision. And don't call me for 30 days kind of thing. So it worked, right? It worked.
Right?
We're here. We're married.
I love these stories. I love these stories.
He will tell you that I chased after him and did all this crazy stuff. And he wants to say that I, you know, texted him about the drink and was chasing after him. I specifically told him, do not contact me because I didn't want to put myself in a situation to be compromised with the relationship I was in and be called a cheater and all that mess. So it just, you know, he can say whatever he wants to say, but he did have a lot of women in different ports because, you know, he traveled a lot. Let's just say that he had to get rid of all the other women. I made sure that was going to, like, you have to get rid of Susie and Kelly and Martha. And he was like, he was a total player. You know, they used to call him Jay Teaser, and now they call him Jay Pleaser because he pleases me. No, Jay Pleaser, right, not Jay Teaser.
That is.
Call him Jay Pleaser next time. He'll be so mad. Definitely Jay Pleaser.
Well, you know, so we don't leave him hanging in the bush, you know, too much. The one thing I do love about talking, because I love my wife. We've been married 27 years. I think she's one of the most beautiful people on the planet. And Spencer's in a great relationship. When we're sitting by the pool, it's so cool because at first I thought you guys were newlyweds because he just adores you and the way he talks about you, and it just, the love just pours out of every part of his body. And then I find out you've been married like 10 years. I'm like, wow, that is what everybody should dream of, to have that kind of passion for your spouse still down the road. And
well,
I think
one of
that's
the things
beautiful.
I asked him to do was to, become a Christian and join the church where I attend, because in my opinion, I am very much about do not be unequally yoked. And so that's my belief system. And he did. And he is an immense Bible study group now, and he loves it. And he's learned a lot over the years, the last 10 years, about the Bible and about, you know, about being the leader of the house and different things of that nature. And he's enjoying it. And I'm enjoying watching him grow as a Christian. And one of his sons went down and became a Christian. So that was, you know, that was a good thing to me, that we all have the same belief system. It's important to have the same belief system, because if you're trying to be in a relationship and you're battling against each other about, well, I believe this and I believe this, it just makes it more difficult to stay together. And then whenever we do have issues, we can, you know, go and pray about it, or we can study. We can't do, for instance, I can't do BSF. I don't have the time. It's just too much. If you know what I'm talking about, Bible study fellowship, it's just a lot of homework. So I said to him the other day, because we have a couple that does that, I have little books. Let's just go through like John and answer these questions together as a couple. And then we both learn and we're studying at the same time. We're growing closer together. Now that's our belief system. That's what we do. So, but that's not for everybody, but it works for us.
Well, that's beautiful. Well, yeah, we got to close pretty soon because I know you're busy. But in closing, you know, you have the floor. If you could give your teenage self some advice, what would it be?
If I could give my teenage self some advice, it would be stay on your path of what you want to accomplish, be authentic, live your life with purpose, whatever that is at the time. And don't worry about what other people are saying or thinking about you, or how you may look at 12 or 13 or 14 or 16, because in 10 years, you're going to be a completely different person. From 20 to 30, you're going to be a completely different person. And every 5 years, you change dramatically. But as long as you stay true to yourself, follow what your morals and ethics are that you believe to be true, then I believe we will create a life that is successful, happy, and rewarding.
Perfect. You know, on that note, thank you so much. And it's been an honor talking to you.
Thank you for the opportunity. pleasure. And I hope you guys come back and we get to see you next time at the new house.
Me too.
At the new house.
There you go.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Crackin' Backs podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you follow us on Instagram at Crackin' Backs Podcast. Catch new episodes every Monday. See you next time.